Welcome to the All's Authors Podcast. We're so glad you found us. I'm Mary Ann Schuco, a registered nurse, author, and dementia daughter. Please join me for bi-weekly episodes with our authors as we talk about their dementia journeys, sharing intimate details and painfully obtained knowledge to help others currently on that path. We hope these stories offer you comfort and support as we strive to break the silence and stigma surrounding a dementia diagnosis. May one of our authors speak to your experience. When a family member is diagnosed with dementia, a number of complicated issues may arise. Family conflict, the reemergence of old slights and misunderstandings, disagreements on how to provide care or navigate the journey, and more. Mediator and conflict coach Kimberly Best is passionate about helping others resolve such conflicts in a productive, non-litigious way and in finding optimal solutions to problems for all parties involved. She spent most of her career as a registered nurse in intensive care, trauma, and emergency medicine, where she cared for people in extreme need and gained valuable experience in the healthcare system. This inspired her to become a civil and family mediator. She is the owner of Best Conflict Solutions, where she provides conflict coaching and civil, family, healthcare, and elder mediation in Franklin, Tennessee. She serves on the board of the Tennessee Association of Professional Mediators. She is a speaker and trainer on conflict management, transitions, and difficult decisions involving end-of-life issues. Kim is the author of How to Live Forever, a guide to writing the final chapter of your life story. In this episode, we discuss the value of professional mediation in dementia care, why your story is your legacy, how to control the final chapter in your life, and the fine line in caregiving between hope and regret. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the All's Authors Podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Marianne. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here today to talk with us about a very important topic called mediation, which is a subject we have not yet explored on the podcast. So that is great. You get to be a first. And I want to hear all about that. But first, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and about your book and your dementia journey, that would be terrific.
That sounds great. You gave me three big topics there. So my book is How to Live Forever, a guide to writing the final chapter of your life story. Like you, I'm a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for over 40 years. Later, I'm sure we'll talk about my move from a career in nursing. I'm still a nurse into mediation. But I wrote this book because through a career of nursing and through my own personal experience with caregiving, which was your third question, my life came full circle. We see people in caregiving struggle to make difficult decisions. There is a process to, I think, our final chapter. There's a process that we, most of us haven't learned that can help us end well, you know. So in my book, I tell stories about patients and people that I have known who have gone through, life-ending terminal illnesses, accidents, and had to make decisions about what to do next and how to live so that they could write the end of their story well. I want to say, Marianne, that for me, the very first person I saw die, I was a 19-year-old nurse sitting at her bedside, and I was thinking that her life was a story. Like, I literally pictured a book with the two ends just closing, just slowly coming together. And I wondered about the things that she hadn't shared with other people. I wondered what her joys, her love, her secrets, I just wondered that. And through my whole career, that never left me when I saw people's life end. So it came to me while I was writing the book that, you know, if I think of my life as a story, who I am in that moment is influenced by how I want my story to be for other people around me, and for as my legacy. Because I believe the reason my book is titled How to Live Forever, our story is our legacy, you know. And writing it, especially at the end when it's so difficult, is important. It matters. So that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to talk about decisions around legal matters. I formulated a list of the fun stuff that we should all have in order for our family and relatives to be able to find, our family and friends. I wanted to talk about healthcare decisions. And then at the end of the day, the most important thing to everyone is relationships. And we all have hurt and broken relationships. I had one hospice reverend tell me that in his institution, he estimated that 50% of the patients in there had broken family relationships that they were completely estranged from and were dying without healing that. So the power of being able to find a way to heal those relationships. And I think it's about, you know, mitigating for regret for all of us, for us going through life, for us being caregivers through life, so that we can have the best ending, because I think that that is our legacy.
All of that just sounds so deep and necessary. And I know that our caregivers and our listeners caught up in a dementia journey may not even realize that the necessity of some of these things, because they're so busy every day putting out little fires and attending to small emergencies, just trying to keep their head on straight, managing to juggle all of their different responsibilities. So I'm really glad that we're going to have this discussion today. I want people to know that this is something that they can put in their caregiver toolbox, and that they can, there are tools and there are people available to help them with these kinds of decisions and these activities. So if you were speaking to a family where there were a diagnosis of dementia, and perhaps it was, well, we'll just say at the beginning, when a dementia diagnosis is made, what would be the advice to them?
Oh, that's a great question. And ironically, one of my very first clients as a mediator was exactly that. It was a very successful attorney whose wife was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And they had some family difficulties that resulted in estrangement. And the man said, you know, I've came into this life well, I want to finish well, and for my wife as well. So we held mediations to bring as much closure to the relationships and negotiate how they could walk through this path with the family who was estranged being present. We kept the wife present as well, to the extent that she was able to participate, which was really awesome. One thing we talk about when we're talking with mediation and decision-making is capacity, right? And as nurses, we kind of know that we can't assume capacity, that there can be more going on than we're aware of. I'm sure your caregivers understand that too. So keeping people present for decisions, I think is honoring, to try to honor people's choices along the way. So to answer your question, the advice I would give them is know it's a difficult journey. Reach out for help as much as possible. Tap into other people's wisdom. Know that it's an act of love. You know, it is in some form of love, even if it's a difficult relationship. It's a form of love to be caring for someone else. And to whatever extent you can, have the hard conversations ahead of time. And I do outline a lot of those kind of conversations in my book, but have a plan so that you don't have to guess what the person might want or what you should do in a certain situation. And those are hard questions, right? But I have not met one person who regrets having the hard conversations and knowing what to do next when those times come. I have met countless people who didn't and had to make spur of the moment decisions that they still agonize over, not knowing if that was the right thing to do. So try to be proactive. Be kind to yourself would be another piece of advice I would give. And, you know, no, this is life. I mean, this is the part of life we don't grow up. We grow up, you know, with Walt Disney movies and fairy tales and stuff. And this is a real part of life. And it's hard. It can hurt, but we do learn so much from it. We'll all be there eventually, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So what exactly is mediation?
Great question. I wish everybody knew about it. It's a problem-solving tool. We all know what litigation is, right? Like, and we live in a society that likes to sue people. And, you know, we want somebody to fight our battle for us, and we'll just hire somebody who will do this, and the presumption is we're going to win. I'm here to tell everyone, and I don't think many lawyers would disagree with me, really nobody wins. When we litigate, the presumption is someone wins and someone loses, right? But in the end, everybody loses because it escalates conflict, it escalates the legal process, escalates division, till we don't have, it's hard to stay connected. So mediation is an alternative to that. It can be done at any time, once litigation started or well before that, even with small conflicts, where a neutral, that would be me, and we say we're neutral, we're impartial. I say we're omnipartial because you can't really be neutral without and have, you know, warm blood in you. Neutral means you don't have thoughts or feelings. We all do. Omnipartial means I advocate for each person and I help them to hear each other. I help them to understand what's being said and I help them design a process moving forward that helps take care of their problem. So what happens when we're upset, especially around issues like that, is the people become the problem. You are the problem. You won't do something I need. You are the problem. And if we separate the people from the problem, you are still who you are that's good and beautiful and right, and not just the problem you're bringing to the table. So we make it safe, right, to have these tough discussions. And then it's all about opening options. A lot of times with decisions, we think we either can do this or this. And I put those two things on a spectrum and say, what about all the things between those? So that there's more potential solutions than two, because there always is. And this helps people stay in relationships. It helps create win-wins instead of win-loses. It helps teach conflict skills for later that most of us haven't learned how to do conflict well. I speak on conflict and I'm like, oh, would you like me to talk to your company on conflict? And people are like, ah, don't say that word. So I have to say it a nicer way. But, you know, almost always, 99% of the time in conflict, I have two really good people who are just hurting. And all they can see is people are like, oh, he's a narcissist. She's a narcissist. The truth is none of us are as narcissistic. All of us are narcissistic when we're in pain, because when we're in pain, it's all about us. And so mediation opens that space where we can bring a better version of ourselves, you know, try to heal the pain, but bring the part of ourselves that thinks and can be more open to working things out, because there always is another way. It's also a systems design approach to moving forward. So we can figure out what works and then redo it as needed, right? Evaluate it and redo it. So the flexibility, because I think sometimes in caregiving, it's like, well, I did this and I didn't work, therefore, or you said you do this and you didn't do this, so therefore it's not going to work. And instead of those being walls, I want to make those doors. Well, that didn't work. What part of it did? What can we do next instead of just stopping at the no?
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with families where dementia is a factor, what kind of issues do they usually bring to you? What kind of problems are they needing to have mediated?
Yeah, so the truth is, I think for most of the terminal and end of life decisions, they're similar. I think for dementia and Alzheimer's in particular, the hurts are around not being recognized. Maybe overreactions, you know, to emotional reactions that are so a lot of potentially even guilt, which is common across the board with that. But for that, you know, myself, beyond being a mediator, I'm a conflict coach. So in conflict coaching, it is, you know, knowing what you need to wear and what is not yours. You know, what is something you need to accept and deal with versus what is someone else's reaction that you can maybe let that deflect off of you instead of carrying it. So I think you might have a little bit more of that because of the confusion, the lack of recognition. I know in my own life with my dad, who I had mentioned to you earlier, I took care of for the last 10 years of his life. It still haunts me that my dad thought I was his wife, not my mom, because he didn't like my mom even a little bit, but maybe it was the vision of a wife he had, somebody taking care of him. I was my dad's daughter, you know. So the part of it is not being seen. You know, you're going out of your way to care for somebody and they don't know who is doing that. But I think part of it is really hard too, is the role change. The role changes are hard. And I think that's probably hard in any kind of aging process as well.
That's helpful. Thanks for sharing all of that. How did you become a mediator from your role as an RN?
So I worked in every intensive care there was, and ultimately the emergency department. And it's heartbreaking work. So I decided at one point, because I started early at 19, that I love people and I like it fascinating, the biology of people, but so does the psychology of people. So I went to graduate school in psychology. And I realized that I have the heart of an ER nurse, and in psychology, no offense to psychologists, but that change is slow. And, you know, it's just a very slow process if you see it at all. So I went back to nursing, and then I went through a really bad divorce and saw how the legal system, I've been through the legal system before and have seen how just contentious it is and what a fight it is being involved in legal processes. But this divorce took the cake. And my brother, who is an educator, told me about mediation, a mediation type called transformative mediation, which is out of Hofstra University and now out of Dayton. But I looked into it. I went to Hofstra, took courses, and fell in love with the concept of a way to handle our conflict that doesn't destroy ourselves and other people, that there's a kinder, gentler way that works if we can make this space safe. So I went back to graduate school in conflict management, got my master's in that, and just proceeded to learn, went to Florida to their elder in their healthcare training at the University of Florida. And really anywhere opportunity I could get to learn more about how we can do conflict better. And just leaned into that. I believe if we can learn how to handle ourselves in conflict and the tools, it's just a set of tools. If we can learn this, it is life-changing. And we all know like how many problems there are with conflict now and just how almost hate-filled the whole atmosphere feels for all the contention going on. And I feel like if we can do this one person at a time, one family at a time, learn these tools where we don't have to beat each other up, where we can still respect each other and have differences, you know, where we can understand that we have more in common than we don't, that it's our best hope for a future.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, these are all really great strategies because I hear often in during the podcasts and just reading some of the posts and the books that are in the All's Authors collection, so many families, when there is dementia diagnosis, there is a lot of, you know, infighting and siblings who don't get along or they just don't agree on the situation, or one parent pit against the other parent or against the children, especially. That's, you know, very common. So instead of trying to deal with these on situations on their own, which they probably lack the skills, it's good to know that there is somewhere to go, whether it's through, you know, the pages of your book or to give you a call and set up an appointment with you or another mediator to get a professional involved to help manage some of these differences and to make this time in that person's life and the family's life, you know, a little smoother, more manageable.
I want to say too, you're spot on. I want to say that what happens with this is probably the most challenging thing that families go through besides divorce, right? Walking through somebody through the end of life. So the pre-work, like I outline in my book, I think is one way to avoid those things, even when you have family conflict. But what you typically have is families who have a family lifespan worth of issues that are unresolved because of lack of tools. This is normal. Like this is what happens because we haven't built a skill set. And then they come together in something really hard and they still have the power struggles they had when they were kids. They still have the same family dynamics that they've just smoothed over and not dealt with. And they just, it kind of explodes around these big issues. Plus you have the stress of what one client said to me, you know, I didn't realize how much I literally held someone's decisions around someone's life or death in my hand. So you have that stress on top of it. And it's a lot. It's a lot. And it's worth getting someone else, you know, to sit in the space that can help you dig through that, whether it's a mediator or anyone else that's wise enough to do that and not choose sides. The thing I love about mediation is it's never about blame. Again, as a neutral, you know, I'm for both people. That is, I see their point and help their point be heard. So it's not about blame because blame doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't help solve the problem, right? It's about finding resolutions to the problem. And there's a lot of hard problems with that end of life, a lot of hard problems with, you know, dealing with family members and loved ones with Alzheimer's and dementia.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a lot in my nursing career or even in my own family. Just being confronted with things that you don't even, not even have an awareness that they're going to pop up or that it's going to be your problem.
Yeah. It seems like sometimes, you know, the next wave comes, you're like about the time you get your breath from one thing, it's hard to predict. Right?
Like yeah, like, there's no predictability. Mm-mm. And you think you've got it together and then something else pops up, another crisis that, you know, you thought maybe you had resolved, or it's just something brand new into the situation, or some kind of outside factor like issues with insurance, maybe, you know, you got it all together and things are going smooth and you can breathe. And then all of a sudden you get some notice from the insurance company, everything is upset again. Or, you know, the home health situation falls apart, the aide quits, or you can't get somebody in on the day you need them the most, stuff right. like that. You know, it's just,
it's hard. I remember asking my dad as he was older, I said, why didn't you tell me that life could get this hard? And he laughed and said, no one told me. And I mean, this is life and it gets that hard. And I think one service we can do is let our kids know we're modeling for them how to get through with us. And that's the one thing I have told families before when they've come in. I had a client come in with a terminal diagnosis and I talk about him a lot because I had such a great relationship with him. And I learned from all of my clients too. You know, we learn from each other. And he came in, he was a football player with a, you know, now terminal diagnosis that did involve a brain injury. And he had eventually progressive paralysis and was going to die. And he came in and he said, I've lived a great life. I have this diagnosis. I'm just going to sit in the chair and wait to die. And I'm like, well, that's an option because, you know, I'm a mediator, as many options as we can get so we can choose the right one. I said, that's an option. But let me tell you, the same thing happened to my dad. He received a terminal diagnosis that he thought he should never have. And he decided not to live. And he lived 20 more years.
Right.
So we're still writing our story, you know. And I said, you are modeling for your children. I would ask my dad when I sat at his bedside to help me know what to do, like to set, can you set an example for me? Can, because he was the one going through it. So I guess that's another one of those hard conversations. And my dad was not the person who was going who was going to help me figure out anything. But, you know, we are modeling for our kids. And I think having the conversations like you have, like we're having, also models for our children a subject that was taboo. We weren't going to talk about the fact that we weren't going to live forever, or that we had other options besides what a medical system told us, you know, that we could take control of our own destination and decisions around end of life things and legal things. And, you know, we can model a whole new way. And I think it's just brave to show up to have these conversations, to listen to these conversations, and to learn from other people's experiences.
Oh, true. I was fortunate because my mom would always, she was a very devout Catholic woman, and she believed that when she would die, she knew that would happen. But for her, it was to be a joyous occasion because she would finally be with the Lord. And that was her life's goal. Really, she lived her life for that outcome. And so she would always tell me literally what plans she had for her end of life. So when that time came, I had that. I knew that. I had that knowledge. So that was a really great thing. But one of the things that she always insisted upon, and I know a lot of caregivers get this, is don't ever put me in a nursing home. Mm. She was terrified of having to go into a nursing home. And unfortunately, she, at the end of her life, she was on hospice. She did end up in a nursing home for a short time. So how do you deal with families when they have that?
You know, that speaks to my own. I, like I said, my dad lived with me. And then when I went through the divorce, my dad had his own little apartment over the garage, and, you know, was happy there. And I couldn't keep that place. And I had a son still at home and had to transition to another house. And I moved my dad to an assisted living place up near my aunt in Columbus, Ohio. I'm in Tennessee. And I promised my dad that I would find a place for him better than where he was. And I meant to do that. And his health decreased pretty quickly after the move. I did bring him back down here to the best assisted living place I could find, the prettiest place on the planet. And it turned out to be a nightmare. And, you know, he died within a year. So I think that we're doing the best we can. I mean, this is something I feel like I have to forgive myself for. I sometimes talk to my dad and ask him to forgive me. It's probably part of why I do what I do, to help mitigate for that guilt. I say we walk a fine line in caregiving between hope and regret. And what a fine line that is. So we have to have grace in mistakes, because we're always doing the best we can. Hindsight makes everything look different. But when we compare to hindsight, I say we never know. If we'd chosen another route, we don't know that that would have been better. We make an assumption that it would, but that's not fair. We don't know what would have happened. So again, I believe in trying to honor someone's life as much as they can. And then we have to deal with reality, whatever that looks like. Sometimes we have to make decisions that we never thought we would be in that place to do. And all we can do is, you know, give ourselves grace and do the best we can. That's the stuff that's not easy, right?
No. The day that they took my mom from her home and to go to the facility, because like I said, she was on hospice, and they said she only had 1 or 2 weeks left. And we just couldn't keep doing it. We couldn't do the care at home. We didn't have enough able bodies 24/7. So that was one of the worst days of my life, was when they came, you know, with the ambulance to transport her out of her home for the last time. And she was she knew what was going on, but I don't know if she really knew it was gone. She didn't have dementia, but she was like, why is everybody crying? You know, and I'm like, well, Ma, we're kind of sad, you know, we're sad that you have to leave. But she only stayed in that facility for May to July, 2 months. And she rebounded from a woman who had like a week or two to go, she took a rebound rapidly. And my brother hated that place. He couldn't bear to see her there. So he said, I'm taking her home. And he made the arrangements and made his house for her, prepared a place for her and brought her home. She lived for like 4 months.
I love that you speak to a process, Marianne, that somebody didn't lock into something and kind of went with the next right thing. So I would say that wholeheartedly in these decisions, if you can just figure out the next right thing and not make that necessarily a permanent thing, right? So it's for now. We can try this for now. And if this doesn't work, then we change it to something else. Mm-hmm. I hear your hurt in talking about her leaving, and I hear your mom kind of, you know, it didn't hurt her. It hurt you more than it hurt her. And I think that's an interesting thing watching people is we have our own story and maybe we're being harder on ourselves sometimes than that, than the other person is. So I think that's just what love does. That's the price of love that we have these moments that it's like, you know, we carry the fact that maybe we couldn't make it go the way we wanted to. And I have a whole thing about surrender at that point. It's hard. But I believe if the effort is there, if the intention is there, if the flexibility is there, things work out like they're supposed to, you know, with a few blips in there that we wouldn't have, but.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, reflecting up on the situation with my mom, as her daughter, the oldest child, and the nurse, and the one who had the all the powers, the healthcare proxy, the power of attorney. I was her confidant. She trusted me. And we reached that place where, you know, I'm a long distance caregiver as well. I live 250 miles from my mom, and I was not able to be like a full-time caregiver. And reaching the end of those limitations on my part, like I was, you know, recommended to place her in a long-term facility. But that was like, I had the best solution for me, not entertaining the idea that my brother, who stepped up, he stepped up when out of his love for her and said, I'm going to take over now. And so even then I tried to like dissuade them from doing that because I didn't think that they had the I didn't think they knew what they were getting into and they would be able to manage it. And you know, I was kind of right about that. But you know, just giving that up and saying, well, you know, go ahead, go, if she wants to go with you, then you guys do what you need to do. And she did, and they didn't, you know, they were upset at the place because they didn't think that she should leave. And my brother said, you know, well, my mom's leaving here like on the weekend on Saturday, so make sure she's ready to go. And that was it, you know, and he went and he got her and he brought her home. And she lived with him for a few months.
Wow. Wow.
Before she passed. So she was, you know, home with her family at the time of her death. Yeah. So that was a good thing. That's what she wanted. She always, that was the other thing. Don't let me die alone.
Yeah.
She was terrified of it. So she did not. So, I mean, that gives me some peace, but, you know, relinquishing the control now to him and his partner. And she was an RN. She was a home care nurse. So she knew what she was doing, but they both worked.
Yeah.
They were both working full time during this period.
You know, the one thing, I mean, I think that's an absolutely beautiful story that they were able to do that and that you could let go of control. I think that's so important because our tendency is to give a no first. I tell people this all the time. You know, if you have an idea, I think of it as planting a seed. And people's first reaction is usually no, because we're just no cultured. I say consider the yes. You know, you're planting a seed. And if someone says, no, how about this option? No. I say, well, you know, then the next thing is maybe, can you just think about it? Like, I hear you, no, can you just think about it? And if we give that space, I think people would often see the benefit of changing their minds, at least trying it. So I always say, I mean, it kind of hit me about 6 months ago. You know, life is an experiment. Every single moment is one we've never been in before. And sometimes we're going to make the choice that's fantastic And sometimes it's not going to be so well. And what we have to do is have the grace to know, of course, we're not going to get it right all the time, and neither will other people. Now that we see that doesn't work, what can we figure out? Learn from it, you know, just learn from it. What can we figure out to do next? But we kind of go through life like everybody's supposed to know what they're doing all the time. How would we, you know?
Yeah.
Because we've never been in that moment before.
Right.
You know,
no, I never expected that. I never expected to be in a situation with my mom that we ended up being in. My father died. He just dropped dead one day. So I was kind of like, well, hopefully that'll happen to her. And a lot of things would be resolved easily that way. But God had other plans.
Yeah. So that's the funny thing about my book. I took my book to I had, you know, help from John Trent, who's, you know, authored some popular books, and he did my foreword and helped me look for a couple editors. And I had a, you know, pretty big editor who's like, you know, it's a really good book, but nobody wants to talk about end of life. Like, nobody wants to talk about dying. So, you know, good luck on your own with that. And I found she's right. But if we have these conversations ahead of time, it makes for a completely different experience instead of pretending like it's not going to happen or it's not supposed to happen. You know, we plan for just about everything in our life except the end. And the end is as important as the beginning. You know, one is the end of the complement of that, the last of that circle. And we just have to be brave enough to have those conversations. And I think for me, being a nurse, I wonder for you, Marianne, but being a nurse, the thing I learned is just how precious every moment is. And when you're a nurse, you know, you get people from all ages. I mean, I had a 5-year-old niece die from a brainstem glioma. I mean, we're not guaranteed tomorrow, none of us. But if we know what we want and have those discussions the best we can and accept our mortality, I think it makes life sweeter and our moments more purposeful. And when you think about that, when you think about people leaving a funeral home, I've never seen people so committed to living differently as when you leave from the death of someone else. Because in that moment, life has so much poignancy, right? Like, you respect this, here's somebody dead, and you know then that it can be me. But imagine living that way. Because the truth is, we are going to die. But that shouldn't keep us from living well while we can. It should encourage us to live well while we can.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Were you prepared to read to us something from your book?
I will. Thank you for that opportunity. I hope I don't get choked up. Forgive me if I do.
It's okay. Yeah. Makes it better.
Well, when you write a book, you wrote a book, so you probably know this. You kind of unzip your soul. And the hardest part was people first reading my book, because I put all of who I was and what I've learned into that book. And I couldn't go read it on my own afterwards, because it was embarrassing to me to even read it. But this I believe. Finally, this I know to be true. I have one shot at this journey we call life. I don't know how long I have, but I know that I have one day less than I did yesterday. I also believe that we leave our legacy every moment, every interaction, no matter what we do, and no matter where we're from. Every interaction with another person is an opportunity to leave a legacy of kindness or unkindness. Who we are in any given moment lives on. We are told in scripture to number our days. When we do just that, by recognizing the finite nature of our days, I believe we can live purposefully, write a beautiful story, and die without regret.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you would like to tell the listeners before we say goodbye?
Oh, actually, there is. I was speaking to a group, and some were dementia not very long ago. And I sat and thought, what What would I want to say? For what we've walked through as people living our lives and as caregivers, and thank you is what came to me. And it was, thank you for what you have sown. Thank you for what you've created. For what you've shared. For what you've endured. For how you've changed the world. For who you are and for your story.
So much. It's beautiful.
It's an honor. You know, it's an honor everyone here who shared their stories. There's nothing more beautiful. Yeah. And thank you, Marianne, for the work you do.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. This is a work of the heart, passion for all of us on the management team, the seven of us, and so many of the authors who have written their books and shared their stories like you, you know, bearing their souls and telling the family secrets, reliving some of the worst times in their life, putting that on the page.
Well, the rest of us know we're not alone when that happens. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're not alone. There's nothing you're going through or feeling that we all don't have to struggle with. But knowing you're not alone and knowing there are hard choices and sometimes not right answers. And
right.
Yeah, we all have to go through this. It's part of the journey.
There's no good answer sometimes.
And the end of life choices, there is often no good choices. You're in double binds very often, you know. I would like to speak real quick to something of safety, though. This came into me, so I want to let this go. You know, I challenge people who at all costs keep people safe, because in life we value autonomy, you know, choice, freedom, autonomy, very high up. But when we have aging and particularly aging and dementia as well, we tend to value safety over autonomy for those people. And in all surveys, they still value autonomy, their freedom, their ability to do as much as they can for themselves. And we want to put them in bubble wrap. And we're basically wanting to put dying people into bubble wrap. Right. So I think considering like maybe how important is safety really versus quality of life up to the end with those choices around that. I feel bad kind of, Marianna, for saying this because I'm saying it so late in the talk. It's probably anticlimactic, but I do like to challenge the issue of, well, we have to do what keeps them safe. You know, so I asked a woman in her 80s. I was given this as part of a talk, too. And she said, and this lady was sitting there laughing, and she's in her 80s. And I'm like, I noticed you laughing during this. And she's like, well, I broke both of my arms. And I said, would you do it differently? And she said, oh, hell no. You know, so we leap to safety, lock people. I mean, I've seen people just suffer for being locked in dementia wards, not being, you know, and of course, there is safety issues that we do have to consider, but maybe not to the extent that we do, that people's ending could be more fulfilling.
Oh yeah. Well, being a nurse, you know, that's drummed into your head is, well, you have to keep the patient safe because we don't want anyone to get hurt and we don't want the hospital to get sued. So that was another thing. Yeah, that was huge.
I was going to say, we can thank lawsuits for that. That I talk about that to lawyers. I've given my book outline for lawyers and end of life stuff before for continuing education. And I mean, we can thank most of our paralysis on failure. I mean, fear of litigation and being sued, but that's across the board in every area now. So we're tying ourselves into a little cage by not being able to risk making mistakes, which is why I like to speak to the fact that we will make mistakes and so will other people. Let's make some space for that.
Yeah. And with my mom, we, you know, she was such a high risk for a fall and we didn't want her to break her hip. So we did everything that we could to keep her safe and restrictions and this and that. And then one day she was just sitting in her chair and her caregivers were in the kitchen making lunch. And she decided to find out what was going on and got up with her walker, and something distracted her and she let go of the walker and it went off without her. And she went down and broke her hip. And it was like, we did everything we could to not make that happen. And it happened. And she suffered, you know, tremendously for that. But
Atul Gawande would say if she wanted to get up and get around and the broken hip shortened her life by, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, is her spending that time getting up and getting around while she could more value to her. And that's kind of the hard decisions. You know, something else I thought of was, I know a person who was married for 40 something years and his wife died of Alzheimer's, and his biggest regret is having her go through the treatment things that medicine does. So PT coming in and making her walk when she could, it was painful and a struggle for her to do these things, but the system designed all these things. And he just thought, well, they know what they're doing. They should do it. Now he looks back and he's like, she was dying. You know, and I'm doing things to try to keep her moving and alive. You know, and you think about that, and we do encourage those kind of things, and maybe we need to think about
it. Well, the expectation is that there is some kind of medicine that's going to save this person. And a lot of times I would say to people, you know, the person you get back, if that might not, that's not going to be the person that you were expecting. This is going to be so different.
You know, The truth is, in advancing medicine and people living longer, it's taking longer and it's harder for them to die.
Yeah.
That's the consequence of
and
that.
And people think that they won't.
You know,
people
so
expect them not to and put them through all kinds of horrific things, you know, and you see in an ICU.
Exactly.
Is, you know, when people say they don't mind if they end up in the ICU, it's like they don't know what they're talking about.
I hear you. Nope. Or go through surgery. I mean, we just need to be more honest about this. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book, to be honest, about circumstances like that. Anyway, it has been wonderful talking with you.
Oh, same here. I'm really grateful for this time.
Sorry for falling apart a little bit there.
That's okay. Thank you so much for your time. It was just a wonderful discussion and a new topic for us, and to just an exploration of this subject area that I think a lot of people wrestle with and don't really know where to turn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can recommend your book, which is available where?
Pretty much everywhere. I mean, it's on Amazon, but at least it was with most major booksellers.
And it's in the All's Authors bookstore.
Ah, there we go. All's Authors bookstore, yeah.
Yeah, so people can find it there. You can go to allsauthors.com/bookstore and search for the book. It's there. You can search for Kim's post on our website. All of this is in the show notes. And social media, right? You have Facebook and Twitter.
I do. I have, Twitter, Instagram.
Perfect.
LinkedIn, Facebook.
Okay. So
you'll find me.
Go find her.
Yeah.
Go find her, folks. Have a great day. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Marianne. You too.
Thank you for listening to Untangling Alzheimer's and Dementia, an All's Authors podcast. For more details on this episode, please see the show notes. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review and subscribe to it on whichever platform you use to listen to your favorite podcasts. For more information on All's Authors, please visit allsauthors.com. While you're there, be sure to browse our online bookstore, where you will find hundreds of carefully vetted books on Alzheimer's and dementia. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Please email your thoughts on the podcast to allsauthors@gmail.com. We are a 501c3 charitable organization, totally reliant on donations to do what we do. If our author stories move you, please consider contributing to our cause. Remember, You are not alone. One can sing a lonely song, but we chose to form a choir and create harmony.